Well, I'm very impressed with the obedience to instructions and promptness. 2 minutes to 12. Fantastic. One of the attractions of Celtic Christianity, I think, in Britain and Ireland, is that it feels like it is indigenous. It is Irish, it is Northumbrian, it is Hebridean, or whatever. There is a sense of, well, this is a tradition in our islands. That is not the case with Anabaptism. Anabaptism is a central European tradition which tried unsuccessfully to become established in at least England in the 16th century, but never quite made it. And so, to that extent, it feels a bit more like an outsider tradition, an alien tradition. And yet it is one that increasing numbers of Christians in Britain and Ireland and a variety of other cultures are beginning to discover and to appreciate. There's been something of a surge of interest in the Anabaptist tradition over the last 30 years, I guess. Until then, Anabaptism, if it was known at all, was regarded as a fairly uninteresting footnote in Reformation history books. So if you studied the Reformation, you would know all about the Protestants of various kinds and the Catholics and the interaction between them. Oh, and there were these Anabaptists as well, who were a little bit dodgy, but probably aren't significant enough to worry about too much. They are a footnote in the history books. Or, if the textbook went into a little bit more detail, there would be one particular incident in the year 1534, which was taken to define Anabaptism. And it was the disaster at a place called Munster. And it's as if that was the only thing that anybody needed to know about Anabaptism. Those historians who dealt with Anabaptism at all saw it as a problem to be addressed rather than a tradition to be appreciated. And so for about 400 years after its foundation, Anabaptism was either marginalised or vilified or both. And so it's been rather strange over the last 30 years or so, the way in which the Anabaptist tradition has suddenly captured the attention and the imagination of people from a whole range of traditions. I'm part of a group in Britain and Ireland called the Anabaptist Network. We're 20 years old, and we have simply been a place of resource and relationship for people from right across the theological spectrum, pretty well all the major theological traditions, who have found something in Anabaptism that has made them sit up and go, ah, that's interesting. So I don't know whether Anabaptism is entirely new to you today, or whether it's something that you have already explored a little bit. What I want to do is to try to give a very brief outline of the Anabaptist story, and then to focus particularly on some of the values and convictions. Just like Roy was introducing the characteristics of Celtic Christianity, let me introduce you to some of the key characteristics of the Anabaptist tradition. I will mention Munster at some point, but I'm not going to major on it. Let me instead start with a very different story. The Celtic tradition has its saints, and Roy has mentioned several of them by name. The Anabaptist tradition hasn't tended to go in for saints very much, at least not officially, but if there were to be an Anabaptist saint, he would be called Dirk Willems. This is the iconic story from early Anabaptism. How well you can see that picture, but this is a woodcut depicting the key moment in the story of Dirk Willems. Dirk was a young Anabaptist in the town of Asperen in the Netherlands in the 16th century. He was part of an underground Christian community. Anabaptists were being persecuted and the church met in secret. But they weren't secret enough. They were discovered and a number of them, including Dirk, were arrested and imprisoned. Dirk was imprisoned for a number of weeks and he was facing trial. To be an Anabaptist in 16th century Netherlands was potentially a capital offence. He was on trial for his life, or he would be shortly. But it wasn't a very secure prison, and Dirk managed to escape. I don't know whether it was one of these traditional, you know, bedclothes knotted and out of the window, but anyway, he got away. And it was winter, and he ran for his life across the fields and came to one of those canals that you find all over the north of the Netherlands. And it was frozen. But it wasn't very frozen. Dirk had been on prison rations for some time. He was relatively thin and light. and he decided to risk it. The pursuit was already behind him. He'd been discovered, and there were people chasing him. And he legged it across this barely frozen canal. And he got across. His pursuer, however, the bailiff, who presumably was better fed than his prisoner had been, came lumbering after him, followed him across the ice, and then, crack, he falls through. The ice gives way, and he falls into the frozen water. What does Dirk do? What would you do? Dirk turned back and held out an arm and rescued his pursuer. And we see that moment when he does that. And pulls this very cold, shivering bailiff to the bank. And what happens next is interesting, because the bailiff is in no mood to rearrest Dirk. He's grateful for being saved. He's also more concerned about getting dry and warm than he is with his prisoner. But you might be able to see on the bank behind, there are two or three other figures. This obviously is just a picture, but it tells you something of the scene. Others had arrived, and from the bank, one of the figures cries out to the bailiff, "Remember your oath. Your oath to do your job. Your oath to keep the prisoner safe. You must rearrest this man." And that's what happens. Dirk is rearrested, and he is taken to a more secure prison this time. In fact, he's imprisoned in the tower of the church at the back of the picture. The church as a place of imprisonment. Quite an interesting image of church life. And this time there is no escape. Dirk continues to be imprisoned for a number of weeks. He is then put on trial, condemned, and burned at the stake. So it isn't a story with a happy ending. Quite a lot of Anabaptist stories don't have a particularly happy ending. The question that Anabaptists have asked as they told this story over the last five centuries is, why did Dirk turn back? Second question they've asked is, was he right to turn back? And the third question they've asked is, would I have turned back? So it's been a story that has provoked conversation and questions. And one of the conclusions that many have come to in relation to the first question, why did he turn back, was it must have been an instinctive reaction. When people fall through the ice, they go down quickly. Dirk did not have time to do a Bible study on the ethics of what you do in this situation. He didn't have time to consult his pastor or his community. It was a snap decision. He turned and he rescued the man. Should he have done that? Or should he have continued running and escaped? What would I have done? What would we have done? Anabaptists have continued to ponder that question. One of the reasons it seems why Dirk made the decision he did was that we know a little bit about the community he was part of. He was part of an Anabaptist community that focused their attention strongly on the Sermon on the Mount. And the passage in the Sermon on the Mount that talks about loving your enemy was really important to this community. Love your enemy. Love your enemy. Love your enemy. If you read that and reflect on that often enough, maybe it shapes you into the kind of person who behaves like that. I find this an intriguing and challenging story. And increasingly I have been interested in reflexes. What kind of reflexes do we have in emergency situations? I've become less interested in what I or others believe, less interested in rules and regulations, I'm more interested in reflexes. In a situation where I haven't got time to think about how I'm going to respond, what will I do? What will I say? How will I act? I'm interested in reflexes, and I'm also interested in how we as communities develop those kinds of reflexes. It's back to the issue of discipleship we were looking at earlier. What kind of disciples are we creating in our communities? What kind of people are we becoming? How do we respond in these emergency situations? Now, of course, with stories, we aren't given a simple conclusion. We might conclude on the basis of this, what a stupid thing to do. Why didn't he just keep running? That's what I would have done. But it provokes questions about how we live and how we respond. And it's one of a number of very provocative stories from the Anabaptist tradition. The Anabaptist tradition is a narrative tradition. It has told stories over and over again through the centuries. And there is something about stories which I think is tremendously helpful in our context and culture. Storytelling has become increasingly popular recently. There's a reluctance to simply be told what to do or how to live in our wider culture. And that may be true in our churches too. I think something of the power of the story may be something that we need to recover. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Let me tell you a bit more about the Anabaptist tradition out of which Dirk came. Let me take you back a few years earlier. This is the Dirk story is towards the end of the 16th century. But let me take you back to 1525 and to the city of Zurich in Switzerland. The Protestant Reformation is now in full swing. It's a few years after Martin Luther nailed his theses to the door in Wittenberg, and the Reformation began to sweep across Europe. In Zurich, we have Ulrich Zwingli, the great reformer, who is the pastor of the Grossmünster, the big church in the centre of Zurich, and who is gradually introducing reformed practices, trying very hard to carry the whole city with him if possible, looking for support from the city council, preaching reform, but waiting for the city council to authorise reform. So it's a very steady, gradual reformation that's going on. And among the followers of Ulrich Zwingli are a bunch of hot-headed radicals who are convinced that reform needs to go further and faster. It's not enough to wait for the city council, they say. Scripture says. The Holy Spirit says. Let's just get on and do it. And over the last couple of years, all kinds of radical things have taken place. Idols, icons have been smashed in some of the churches. They've eaten sausages in Lent. I mean, how radical can you get? And this caused an outroar. And in 1525, in the depths of winter, in January, in a small house in Zurich, a group of these radicals met together and reached the conclusion they just simply couldn't wait any longer for the kind of reform they thought was necessary. They weren't opposed to Zwingli. They were pleased at the progress that he'd made, but we're never going to get there if we wait to go at his pace, they said. And in particular, they became convinced that there was one issue which was the kind of bellwether, one issue that they really had to grapple with if they were going to make significant progress, and that was the issue of baptism. Yes, they'd all been baptized as infants. Everybody was in Zurich. But their reading of Scripture had convinced them that baptism was not for infants, it was for believers. It was for those who chose to be followers of Jesus, those who wanted to be disciples. And as they met together in this small house in Zurich, they faced the question, what are we going to do about this? And it was a very serious issue, because having been baptized as infants, what they were now considering doing was being rebaptized. And that was a capital offence. Had been for 1,000 years in Europe. Of course, they didn't regard it as rebaptism because they didn't see their infant baptism as valid. They just called it baptism, but they knew everybody else would see it as rebaptism. And so, as the early documents say, after a time of heart-searching and prayer, when they were wrestling with the challenge of this, they baptized each other. And at that point, effectively put themselves outside the law. And that was really the beginning of the Anabaptist movement. The term Anabaptist means rebaptize. And it was the term used not by the group themselves, but by those who were opposed to them. They simply called themselves Christians, or brothers and sisters. But they were labelled as rebaptizers by those who thought what they were doing was outrageous. And as they began to spread outside of Zurich, the city very quickly became too hot for them. They had to spread out into the countryside. It began to spread like wildfire. People began to get hold of this new and more radical way of being disciples. It wasn't so much the issue of baptism. That was perhaps the symbol of something which was more to do with a different way of being church, a different understanding of the gospel. And as they spread out into other areas, they found that they weren't alone. Actually, all over Central Europe, groups were beginning to emerge which had very similar convictions. In Austria, in the south of Germany, North Germany, in the Netherlands. I don't know how much you've been aware of the so-called emerging church movement of the last 10 to 15 years in much of Western culture. Well, this is the emerging church of the 16th century. Groups of Christians in different parts, different places, all of whom seem to be discovering something similar at the same time and eventually find one another. So Anabaptism is not some kind of unified movement. It's more of a coalition of groups all over the place who seem to be discovering similar things from the scriptures. When you find similar groups all over the place that have no institutional connection, one of the rather awkward suspicions is this might be God doing something. Of course it might not, but it's one of those suspicions that you have to sort of wonder about. However, the authorities didn't think it was God. In fact, they thought it was Satan. They thought this was heresy. They thought this was subversion. They thought this was terrible. We need to recognize that in the 16th century, this was a time of significant turmoil in this part of Europe. Not only was the Reformation happening, which was throwing everything into disarray in terms of church, but this was the transition period from feudalism to early capitalism. Economics were changing. The politics were changing. Empire was giving way to lots of city-states. Culture was changing. Printing had been invented, and so all kinds of things were being read that previously wouldn't have been. Europe was in turmoil. The peasants were revolting, as always. But 1523, 4 and 5, right across Central Europe, peasant movements calling for social justice. And so there was just this sense of everything is changing. Just as Roy was saying earlier, the Celtic tradition emerged at a time of significant culture shift, so too the Anabaptist tradition, a time of major culture shift. Maybe that's why these movements might be prophetic voices to us. At a time of culture shift ourselves, maybe we need to listen to those who journeyed through previous culture shifts. Both Catholics and Protestants found the Anabaptist movement very troubling. One of the very few things that Catholics and Protestants agreed on in the early 16th century was that Anabaptists were bad news and needed to be got rid of. And so there was some pretty nasty treatment meted out, which we'll come back to. But let me just briefly talk with you about some of the core Anabaptist convictions, some of the things that these groups did agree about. Because it was a coalition of independent groups, if you like, they had differences between them. They weren't all the same. This isn't a uniform movement. But there were certain things that they agreed on, and these in particular. First of all, Anabaptists agreed that Christendom was a problem. For 1,000 years, it had been taken for granted that church and state should be united, that Europe was a Christian culture. And the Protestant reformers, although they wanted to reform the church and to some extent reform society, didn't want to change that basic equation. The Protestant reformers were as committed to Christendom as the Catholics had been. There was a basic agreement about that. The Anabaptists said, no, Christendom is wrong. Christendom is flawed. We shouldn't have church and state in this kind of symbiotic relationship. We don't live in that sort of Christianized culture. This is phony. They said that the partnership between church and state was illegitimate and was damaging to both. Wasn't good for the empire, wasn't good for the church. Secondly, they believed that evangelism was necessary. And this was deeply offensive in a supposedly Christian culture. Why would you need evangelists in a Christian culture? Roy mentioned earlier the move away from apostolic and missional towards the training of pastors and teachers. If you go back to the New Testament and the 2 or 3 centuries after that, you find that apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers represented that diversity of ministry the church needed. Pioneering ministry as well as more pastoral ministry. For 1,000 years in Christendom, those 5 ministries had effectively become 2. Christendom needed teachers and it needed pastors, but that's all it seemed to need. It didn't need evangelists because everybody was now Christian, more or less. It didn't need prophets because if you've got a Christian society, the last thing you need are prophets disturbing it. Prophets disturb the status quo. If the status quo is Christian and as good as it can possibly be, then you don't want prophets. They're a nuisance. And apostles, well, even if we knew what apostles were, would we want them roaming around? Apostles seem to be those who are always on the move. I think it's a Star Trek ministry, to boldly go where no one's gone before. You see that in the early church. These apostles are the missional pioneers. But Christendom is a settled environment. Everybody within their own diocese, their own parish. You don't want these unauthorized apostles around. And that's why people got into trouble when you heard unauthorized preaching going on. It was unsettling people. And so the Christendom church was led by pastors and teachers. It didn't have much space for the pioneering ministries. In fact, if you did come across anybody who was a bit prophetic or a bit apostolic or a bit evangelistic, pain in the neck is the technical term for such people, then the best thing to do is to send them outside of Christendom to heathendom, where they can become missionaries. And we can pray for them. And pray they don't come back too soon as well. And the Anabaptists said, this is illegitimate. Europe is nothing like as Christian as we think it is. It's nominally Christian. It's got a veneer of Christianity. But we need evangelists. We need to preach the gospel. Anabaptism is an evangelizing and church planting movement. Thirdly, they were committed to an understanding of church which was significantly different from the model of church that they had experienced. A community of disciples. Baptism for them mattered because it was a choice to commit to Christ and the community. Baptism was a way of saying to one another, we are together in this. Brother, sister, will you help me follow Jesus? Baptism was a way of marking entry into a voluntary community, a disciplined community, rather than a territorial understanding of church where everybody belongs by dint of birth. Fourthly, Anabaptists focused strongly on the Gospels, particularly on the Sermon on the Mount. That was, if you like, the kind of centre of their spirituality. But they told the stories of Jesus. They believed that the life and the teaching of Jesus was vitally important. Now you might think, well, there's nothing very distinctive about that. Surely all Christians believe that Jesus is important. The concern that the Anabaptists had was that for many of their contemporaries, there wasn't really much interest in the life of Jesus. He was the Son of God, the Son of Man. He was born, he died, he rose again. But the life of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus, the way Jesus related to people, the healings of Jesus, the stories the Gospels tell, there didn't seem to be a huge amount of interest in that. In fact, that seemed to go back a very long way and be very deeply rooted. One of the things that Anabaptists have noted over the years is that if you go to the major creeds of the church, those great ecumenical statements of what Christians believe, there's very little in them about the life of Jesus. Born of the Virgin Mary, what's the next phrase? Suffered under Pontius Pilate. Born of the Virgin Mary, comma, suffered under Pontius Pilate. So the whole of the life of Jesus is a comma. Personally, I don't think that will do. I think something happened between the birth of Jesus and his death. And I think it matters. And Anabaptists through the centuries have said, that matters. It matters that Jesus died, but it also matters that Jesus died. His life and his death are connected. It's not just enough to ask theologically, why did he have to die? We also need to ask, why did they kill him? What was it about the life of Jesus that provoked his arrest and execution? And so the Anabaptists have been very strong on the life of Jesus. Jesus is one to be followed. Jesus as example, teacher, guide. Which doesn't diminish the importance of his death and resurrection, but sets it in context. We'll come back to that. And fifthly, an emphasis on living distinctively. One of the things that most irritated the Catholics and Protestants who arrested and interrogated the Anabaptists was that they were not what heretics were meant to be. The traditional understanding of heresy involved immorality. So if somebody believed the wrong things, inevitably they lived the wrong way. And so heresy and immorality were meant to go together. The difficulty that the inquisitors had with the Anabaptists was that they lived good lives and were known to live good lives. And this was deeply frustrating for the interrogators. There's a wonderful quotation, which I haven't got with me, from a Catholic inquisitor, Franz Agricola, who lists all the things that he has discovered about the Anabaptists, their honesty, their straightforwardness, their kindness, their good neighbourliness. And he says, they have these things in such measure that one would suppose that they had the Holy Spirit of God. Now, he knows that can't be true because they're heretics, but he's sort of scratching his head and trying to work out how they've managed to do this. There's another lovely example of somebody arrested on suspicion of being an Anabaptist, who actually isn't but just happens to live a good life. And he has to really find a way of persuading people that he's not quite as good as they think he is. And there's this lovely exchange in the interrogation where he says, I will curse and swear and do all kinds of things to prove to you that I'm not one of these Anabaptists. So there was something about distinctive lifestyle. One of the concerns that Anabaptists had about many of the churches around them, both Protestant and Catholic, was that the standard of morality in many of those churches was ridiculously low. And they said, in ways that irritated their contemporaries, why do you live this way? If Jesus has called us to be his disciples, why are we doing some of these things? And Protestants in particular got very irritated because it sounded to them as if the Anabaptists were going against justification by faith and calling them back to some kind of works righteousness. And the Anabaptists said, no, we're not doing that, but discipleship matters. We have been saved to be the followers of Jesus. Those are some of the areas in particular. And the kind of distinctiveness focused around three areas in particular. One of those was non-violence. Anabaptists from very early on said that Jesus, the Prince of Peace, calls his followers to be people of peace. We will not fight. And in the time of persistent warfare, in a time when Catholic and Protestant were going to war against each other, and where there was a persistent fear of the Turks invading from the east, to be committed to non-violence was perceived as treacherous, disloyal. Secondly, they were distinctive in terms of the sharing of resources. We'll come back to that, but that was something that really worried people. They seemed to be threatening the whole notion of private property. And thirdly, truth-telling. In the story of Dirk Willems, we heard that phrase, remember your oath. This was an oath-ridden society. People swore oaths all the time. You swore an oath to tell the truth in court. You swore an oath that you were going to deal fairly in business. You swore an oath of loyalty to your city. The oath dominated society in a way that we find it difficult to understand now. And the Anabaptists, because they read the Sermon on the Mount and found Jesus saying, let your yes be yes and your no be no, said we shouldn't be swearing oaths. We shouldn't be swearing oaths because we should be telling the truth all the time. The problem with oath swearing is it gives the impression that I can lie through my teeth the rest of the time as long as I'm not under oath. And they said, actually, Jesus calls us to a better way than that. But again, that worried their contemporaries, because if you can't be bound by the oath, how can you be trusted? All of this was deeply worrying, and the Anabaptist tradition suffered as a consequence. Persecution broke out very early and persisted over the next 30, 40 years in particular. There was a difference. The Protestants tended to behead Anabaptists, the Catholics tended to burn them. Both were effective. Anabaptism is a martyr tradition. It's a tradition that experienced persecution and anticipated persecution. Suffering they saw as not something extraordinary, but as a mark of the true church. One of the signs that they really were the followers of Jesus. As I mentioned earlier, Anabaptism didn't really take root in the United Kingdom. A bunch of Anabaptist refugees did make it to London in 1575. They were trying to escape from some of this persecution and came to London looking for refuge. Once again, even though they tried to keep themselves hidden, they were discovered. And they were imprisoned in London for about a year and were visited regularly by the Bishop of London. The Bishop of London came to them, tried to persuade them to renounce their heresy and to join his church. And the conversations went to and fro, and the bishop got more and more frustrated because these Anabaptists were not doing what he asked them to do. And at one point he just loses his patience with them and he says, you are bad members of my church. To which they responded, but we've never been members of your church. To which the bishop responded, there is no one in England who is not a member of my church. Which is classic Christendom thinking. Eventually, two of the Anabaptists were burned at Smithfield in London. The rest were deported back to Flanders, where they'd come from, presumably to face more persecution. England said very firmly no to the Anabaptist tradition. And it's really only in the last 40, 50 years that Anabaptists have been found again in these islands, as people have taken a fresh look at this tradition and have wondered whether, now that Christendom is coming to an end, a tradition that said no to Christendom 500 years ago might have something to say to us. at a time when many of the mainstream traditions are really struggling to know how to adjust to these changes, may be a tradition that has been on the margins, as a minority, for many centuries, might actually be less phased by these changes and might have something helpful to say to us. And so we've seen the emergence of global Anabaptism. There are networks of Anabaptists now in many different places where there was no historic Anabaptist tradition. We haven't got time to trace that story over the centuries. What I want to do in what time is left is just look with you at a number of the ways in which contemporary Anabaptists, those who draw on the Anabaptist tradition today, have found resources within this 500-year-old tradition. On the back of the notes that were handed out in my first session, you should see a set of 7 core convictions. A few years ago, those of us who were part of the Anabaptist network tried to distill the essence of the Anabaptist tradition, tried to find ways of expressing Anabaptist values and convictions in ways that connected with issues that we are facing today. So what you have there is not some attempted summary of 16th century Anabaptism, it's much more a reappropriation of core Anabaptist convictions translated into the contemporary scene. If you are interested in pursuing it further, one of the books on the bookstall out there is called The Naked Anabaptist and is a book-length exploration of these things. But I just want to focus on 2 or 3 of those in particular. Let me take you to the 5th conviction, which is to do with Christian community, it's to do with church. What kind of church do Anabaptists yearn for? Places of friendship, mutual accountability, and multi-voiced worship. Let me just focus on that phrase. All I'm doing, in a sense, is sampling. There's far more than we can look at in this particular session. Friendship. Why are people leaving church? Why are people dropping out of our churches in large numbers? Over the last 20 years or so, there has been a hemorrhage of people dropping out of church. Many of them are not walking away from faith, but many of them are walking away from church. And there's been quite a bit of research into that. There's a whole genre of Christian literature now around those who are leaving the church. And there are a number of different reasons that those who leave the church give for leaving, but one that comes up again and again and again is the lack of community, the lack of relationships, the lack of real friendship. Institutional belonging might have been sufficient in Christendom, it will not be in post-Christendom. Commitment to activity and program is not sufficient. Insipid forms of fellowship will not do. I just wonder whether we need a moratorium on the word fellowship for a couple of decades, maybe. What is fellowship? I mean, it's a perfectly good biblical word, but I just think it's become debased. We go through to the fellowship hall to have a time of fellowship, which usually means a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, a biscuit, homemade scones, that's a definite markup beyond fellowship, and a number of superficial conversations. What many of those who are leaving the church are saying is we need more than this. We need whole life friendship. We need a level of community that is so much deeper than that. Hospitality. Roy mentioned this in his session, and there are a number of common themes across these two traditions. One of the things that many of us have much appreciated about the Anabaptist tradition is its emphasis on hospitality. The power of food to build community. Something happens when you eat together that doesn't happen when you sit in rows like this. Many of the new churches over the last 10 years or so have discovered the power of food, recognizing that you build community through hospitality. Some friends of mine are church planters, and their mantra is, no eating, no meeting. They don't meet together without eating together. They've discovered something of the power of food to build community. I think for many of these groups, it's been intuitive, it's been instinctive. For others, it's been through reflection on the Gospels, through recognition that Jesus spends an awful lot of time at table or talking about food. There's that fascinating accusation thrown at Jesus that he's a drunkard and a glutton. Unlike John the Baptist, who's this ascetic prophet, Jesus is a party animal, they say. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Don't hear many sermons on that verse. I find it interesting. I don't believe Jesus was a drunkard or a glutton, but he must have been at table often enough for people to think that accusation might stick. The way that John's Gospel tells a story, Roy was talking about the Johannine tradition earlier. John's Gospel starts with the wedding feast at Cana, where Jesus makes copious quantities of obviously non-alcoholic wine. And as you move through the story, you find Jesus often telling parables about feasts and banquets, often at table with a variety of strange people. And then you get the Last Supper, the end of the story, Jesus in an intimate meal with his closest friends. And then after the resurrection, you get the beach barbecue, as Jesus meets with his disciples once again. The whole of the story is embraced by food. Something about hospitality. Friendship, hospitality, community. It just seems to me that these are really important issues. I'm not suggesting the Anabaptist tradition is the only tradition that emphasises these things. Clearly, the Celtic tradition did as well. But for some of us, it's been Anabaptism that has helped us to see that more clearly. An emphasis on community, on hospitality, on eating together. About 12 years ago, a colleague and I wrote a book, or actually edited a book, of stories. 60 Christians from Britain and Ireland who had discovered the Anabaptist tradition. And we asked them to just tell their stories and to identify any influences that had drawn them towards Anabaptism. And for many of them, it was simply friendship with people. But there were certain books that also featured, certain key texts that people had discovered Anabaptism through. And the two most popular, one was John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus, that some of you may know, which is a book of theology. The second most popular book was The More With Less Cookbook. It's a book of recipes. But a book of recipes that also spoke about lifestyle. Some people were theologizing their way into Anabaptism, others were eating their way into Anabaptism. Places of friendship, mutual accountability, and multiverse worship. Mutual accountability. Well, we're back to discipleship. One of the passages in the Gospels that the Anabaptists took very seriously was a passage in Matthew 18, which talks about how you respond when somebody sins against you. When your brother or sister sins against you, what do you do? And that little passage in Matthew 18, the Anabaptists called the rule of Christ. This is the way we're to live in community. Mutual accountability. We live in a society which is averse to that kind of thing. Community that prides itself on tolerance, not being judgmental, and consequently leaves us all floundering in individualism. Anabaptism calls us to mutual accountability. Anabaptism says to me, make yourself accountable to brothers and sisters. Anabaptism says, do you really think you can go it alone? Is heroic individual Christianity really what it's all about? Or do we need to be part of a community where we are responsible to and for each other? Deeply countercultural, deeply unpopular, but maybe essential for a post-Christendom church. How are we going to be a community of discernment and resistance unless we're able to grapple with some of these issues together? I think the Anabaptist tradition offers us something here. What we don't need is some kind of heavy shepherding. What we don't need is some kind of controlling environment. What we do need is gracious accountability to each other. Because, let's face it, we screw up. We get things wrong. We hurt each other. We step off the path. A church community in Yorkshire that I got to know a few years ago took very seriously this passage. They were drawn to the Anabaptist tradition, and they began to really explore this passage in Matthew 18. And it's the only church I've ever come across which has on the wall of the church building this passage in Matthew 18 written up as a poster. And they're basically saying, when we fall out with each other, this is how we're going to respond. And they see that every time they come to worship together. And I think that's interesting. Friendship, mutual accountability, and multi-voiced worship. One of the things that I've discovered as I've interacted not just with Anabaptism, but with a number of renewal movements through the history of the church, a number of those groups that rediscovered the gospel in their generation, was that most of them rediscovered something of multi-voiced church. A church which is not dependent on one or two professionals, one or two gifted people, but which empowers the whole community to participate. And the Anabaptists certainly were evidence of that. One of their favourite passages was 1 Corinthians 14. 1 Corinthians 14 is the most extended description of a worship gathering we have in the New Testament. And it's a passage that talks about what happens when we come together and everybody brings a contribution. Different contributions, a song, a prayer, a prophecy, speaking in tongues or whatever. Everybody brings a contribution. A multi-voiced community. Personally, I believe that's going to be crucially important for our future, for a variety of reasons. One of those is that we're not going to be able to rely upon paid staff in the way we have in the past. The situation in England, I don't know how much it's going to be true in Northern Ireland, is that fewer and fewer churches can afford paid staff. They are needing to become more and more reliant upon the whole community. So I think this is the future that we need to prepare for. I also think it makes for a more healthy and more wholesome community, that we're less passive, we're more active participants. I also think it has implications for mission. How on earth are we going to share our story with people outside the church if we never say anything inside the church? I'm trying to rein myself in from getting too enthusiastic about some of these things. But I think these areas are tremendously important for church after Christendom. Friendship, hospitality, mutual accountability, and a multi-voiced community where we're participants, not passive consumers. Let me just point you briefly to the fourth and the sixth convictions, and both of those in different ways talk about the issue of economics. One thing that you may not be aware of, and no reason why you should be, is that in the 39 articles of the Church of England, Anabaptism is mentioned as something to avoid. Most Anglicans don't seem to know that, because I've asked them, and they just sort of glaze over. But in the 38th article, so it's towards the end, Anabaptism is presented as something that no good Anglican should consider being involved in, primarily for economic reasons. So it's not non-violence, it's not baptism, it's not many of the other things, it's economics. And the problem with the Anabaptist approach to economics was that it seemed to threaten the whole notion of private property. They talked about mutual sharing. They talked about being available to each other. They talked about living in such a way that the needs of the community were met. And some of them practiced common purse community. Some of them shared all their resources. And that was deeply threatening to good Anglicans, who were encouraged to give charitably, but not to engage in that sort of radical economics. Again, we haven't got time to go into this, but I just wonder whether, at a time of huge economic turmoil, it may well be important for us as churches to re-examine our whole approach to economics. Whether principles of Jubilee from the Old Testament, Koinonia from the New Testament, might give us some way of imaginatively reworking what we do. Perhaps that's something we can pick up this afternoon. I haven't got time to push that much further. What would it mean to be good news to the poor? Again, a theme from what Roy was saying earlier. In what way can we be good news to the poor? Why are our churches where they are? Why do Christians live mainly in affluent areas? Are there ways in which we can relocate to the neglected places of empire? Are there ways in which we can reimagine what it means to be a generous and just Christian community? The Anabaptist tradition doesn't have all the answers to that, but it does ask some pertinent questions about lifestyle, about individualism, about community, about something beyond merely meeting together, actually sharing resources together. But briefly, as we draw to lunchtime, the seventh core conviction is perhaps one of the most distinctive aspects of Anabaptism, the insistence that peace is at the heart of the gospel. That is not something which would be true of most Christian traditions through the centuries. Yes, peace with God, but what about peace with each other? What about peace with the enemy? What about enemy-loving, a la Dirk Willems? The vast majority of Christian traditions through the centuries have been committed to the notion of just war. That war is a dreadful thing, but there are certain circumstances where it's the least worst option. There are situations where it is just to fight, to defend yourself and to defend others. The Anabaptist tradition is part of the so-called peace church tradition that has said firmly, no. There are other ways, there must be other ways of seeking justice, apart from through violence. Anabaptism has said no to the notion of redemptive violence, that you can achieve justice through violence. Along with the Quaker tradition, it has perhaps most strongly advocated the pursuit of alternative ways of seeking justice through peaceful means. One of the difficulties the Anabaptist tradition has sometimes had in this area is falling into passivity. And that's certainly one of the accusations sometimes thrown at the Peace Church tradition. Well, it's all very well saying non-violence, but what are you going to do in the face of injustice? It's one of the reasons why many Anabaptists prefer not to use the term pacifist, because pacifist sounds awfully like passivist, do nothing. Whereas actually there is a tradition of creative non-violence to be drawn on, alternative ways of seeking justice and resolution that don't require violence. Again, a massive subject, more than we can do justice to today. But simply to flag that up, and I wonder whether, again, that might be something that a post-Christendom church needs to take seriously. These two issues of economics and non-violence, provision and protection, they're at the heart of human community. And we live in a society that has got things wrong in both those areas, deeply wrong. And we have an unsustainable culture. Is there a call for a prophetic alternative that our churches can reach out for? So, I don't know whether you're hearing any prophetic voices yet, or are just irritated. Or perhaps a bit of both. Sometimes prophetic voices are irritating. Let me finish, as we draw to lunchtime, by pointing you to the first two core convictions, which are about Jesus. Now, surely we can agree about Jesus. We may not agree about economics or about non-violence, but surely we can agree about Jesus. Well, maybe. But it's this Christocentrism of the Anabaptists that was so threatening to their contemporaries. Taking Jesus seriously. Believing that what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount is actually meant to be lived. It's not just some sort of ideal. It's not just for when the kingdom finally comes. It's a mandate for Christian discipleship. Their contemporaries found that outrageous, irritating and disturbing. One of the things that I'm intrigued by is the way in which, in our culture, certainly in England, maybe this is true here as well, there is an increasing disdain for the established church, but continuing interest in and fascination in Jesus. Jesus still has a good press. I mentioned earlier that I collect post-Christendom anecdotes. I have another collection. I have a small but growing collection of atheists who love Jesus. Doesn't that sound strange? Atheists who love Jesus. Those who are professed atheists who don't believe there is a God or a spiritual realm at all, but who are just fascinated by Jesus, who think he's amazing and wonderful. I find that interesting. I would love for them to discover rather more about Jesus than they have already. I would love for them to move from being atheists to being those who know and trust in God. But I'm interested in the fact that they are fascinated by Jesus. And I wonder whether, as we go back to the issue of evangelism that we talked about earlier, whether what we need to be doing more than anything else is talking about Jesus. Not in the old pietistic sense, but telling the story of Jesus. People are fascinated by Jesus. People are drawn to the person of Jesus. One contemporary theologian has said that in the past, it was the death and resurrection of Jesus that really grabbed hold of people and led to salvation. Possibly, in our post-Christendom era, it will be the life of Jesus that people get hold of first. Doesn't mean the death and resurrection of Jesus is unimportant, it's vitally important. But it may be through the lens of the life of Jesus that many will encounter Christian faith. In which case, we need to go back to the Gospels, we need to learn and retell the stories of Jesus. For some of us, it's been that aspect of Anabaptism that has been most significant. It has reintroduced us to Jesus. I grew up in an evangelical Brethren church. And I heard the stories of Jesus as a child in Sunday school. But when I became an adult, I rarely encountered them again. The teaching was almost all from the epistles and the Old Testament. The stories of Jesus were for children. Anabaptism reintroduced me to the stories of Jesus. For that I'm very grateful. That seems to me to be the heart of it all, and I wonder whether it needs to become the heart of it all again for the post-Christendom church. Okay, we have got over into lunchtime. Is there anything you want to ask in terms of clarification very quickly, anything you really didn't understand? Stuff you disagree with, that's fine, we'll come to that this afternoon. Anything that wasn't clear?
Could
Did you hear the question? What's the connection between the Baptist tradition and the Anabaptist tradition? Yeah, it's a very short question with a very long answer. That's a problem. First cousins is probably the best way of describing it. The English Baptist tradition, about 100 years later, initially with some connections with Anabaptists in Amsterdam, but drawing on different streams as well. Baptists are a kind of mixture of Anabaptist and Puritan roots, really. So first cousin relationship is probably the best way of putting it. Some of the things we've looked at, Baptists would say yes to, but by no means all things. So half and half, I guess. David.
Thank you so much, Stuart. I want to just give you some guidance as to what happens now as you move to the fellowship hall for some fellowship. As you eat your way into community, we're going to do it all. The best and the worst. We're really very grateful to Ballinahinch for the facilities they've given to us today, because it's lovely to have such space to think in. I think something about space. Geography is important, and a big space allows you plenty of room to think as you listen, and that's great. And the folks have provided food, which is just wonderful. So what's going to happen is you're going to go out through these doors, through the hallway where you had coffee, into the next room, which is straight ahead of you. On the left-hand side, there's a serving hatch, and there you will be given a plate which has a soup bowl, and it will be filled with soup. I think you have a choice of soups. I have no idea what they are. And then if you move quickly away from there over to your right, there's a table laden with breads. So help yourself to bread. Go find a seat somewhere, because there's lots of seats. The tables are all set. And then as you munch away happily there, eventually the bread will be removed and the desserts will be put there, and then you'll be obviously invited to come back up and help yourself. We need to be back here at what time, Stephen?
45 minutes.
We've got 45 minutes. And just again to make the point that there are two bookstalls out there. There's a book here by Peter McDowell, who you met earlier, who introduced the morning, recently published, At Home in Exile, which is really looking at the theme of exile and what that might say to us and for us as contemporary churches. And this one I had up here to give a plug to as well. And when you say it quickly, don't let your mind linger on this, okay? The Naked Anabaptist, Stuart Murray Williams. There are some copies of it out there, and you're more than welcome to go and pick them up, okay? So if you'd like to quickly move, and before you do, we'll just express our gratitude to God for our time together this morning, and for the food that we're going to eat. Father, we give you thanks for the opportunity of fellowship together in this place, the coming together, the thinking together, the learning together, and the sharing together that is our privilege. And we give you thanks for the provision of good food and the opportunity of time together. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, folks, if you'd like to quickly keep moving, that's great.